content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. Welcome back. We're reading this week from the February 19th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows former President Trump. He is in the foreground. He's actually wearing, I don't know if you'd call it a hat or a headdress. It's kind of an animal skin type thing with horns on it. It was one of the most conspicuous of the Capitol rioters had a headdress like this on. He's got kind of a nondescript expression on his face. He's bare-chested, and he's got a big red, white, and blue Q tattooed on his chest, the symbol of the QAnon conspiracy. And the headline is, "Who Done It? What the Trump Impeachment Trial Has Shown About Trump's Role in the Insurrection." And that's our first main story. Democrats press their incitement case against Trump. What happened? At Donald Trump's impeachment trial in the Senate, Democratic House managers this week offered vivid evidence to prove their charge that the former president deliberately encouraged a violent insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. Impeachment managers screened a wrenching 13-minute video that showed violent scenes from the uprising, including a bleeding Capitol police officer screaming as he was crushed in a doorway, and rioters taunting and punching overwhelmed police, interspersed with Trump's admonitions at a rally that day to fight like hell and stop the steal or our country will be destroyed. After Trump told supporters, "You'll never take back our country with weakness," the video showed, the crowd began chanting, "Invade the Capitol." The assault that followed was the framers' worst nightmare come to life, said Representative Joe Neguse of Colorado. Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, who'd buried his 25-year-old son the day before the uprising and was with his daughter during the siege, broke down as he described hearing rioters pounding on the door like a battering ram as petrified lawmakers called their loved ones to say goodbye. "Senators, this cannot be our future," he told a riveted gallery. Trump, Raskin later said, watched the insurrection on TV like a reality show. He reveled in it while ignoring pleas to call in the National Guard. Trump attorney David Schoen argued that the trial was driven by pure, raw, misguided partisanship. He and co-counsel Bruce Castor contended that Trump's use of the word fight was not literal and that it was unconstitutional to convict him now that he's out of office. Their meandering, convoluted presentation was widely panned and reportedly had Trump yelling at his TV at Mar-a-Lago. "I ain't no lawyer, but I know enough to know that that was some bad stuff," said Senator Richard Burr. After opening arguments, six Republicans joined Democrats in a 56-44 vote affirming the constitutionality of the trial. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell reportedly told his members to go with their consciences in the final verdict and said he was undecided. Still, with 17 Republican votes needed, a conviction remained highly unlikely. "President Trump will be acquitted," said Senator Ted Cruz. What the editorial said: "We stand at a moment that will shape the future of our democracy," said the Chicago Sun-Times. After watching the chilling Capitol footage, the Confederate flags flying, the chants of "Pence is a traitor," police being mercilessly beaten, Republican senators must ask themselves how they can honestly vote not guilty. They can send a message to future presidents that assaults on democracy will not be tolerated, or they can spinelessly turn their backs on democracy. This is a needless partisan exercise that will further polarize America's political factions, said the Wall Street Journal. Trump's speech was disgraceful, but he did tell the marchers to behave peacefully. Given the certainty of an acquittal, the trial won't produce the deterrent or censoring effect that Democrats claim to want. Their real goal is to stoke their greatest unifying principle, hatred for Donald Trump. What the columnist said. Raskin did a masterful job of proving Trump's guilt, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. He drove home the horror of the event in heart-wrenching personal terms, using video and Trump's own words to show that Trump committed an unprecedented betrayal of office. Raskin also used history, law, and logic to demolish the notion that outgoing presidents get a free pass to commit high crimes in their last weeks in office. For Republicans who won't hold Trump responsible, the verdict is already in. Meanwhile, Trump's lawyers made My Cousin Vinny look like Clarence Darrow, said Charlie Sykes in TheBulwark.com. After the Democrats' powerful, passionate offense, the Trump team's incoherent performance seemed to underline the most cartoonish way possible the reality that Donald Trump really has no good defense. So it is Republican senators who are actually on trial. The trial was a dud, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. Trump's angry January 6 speech was reckless, but he never called for violence, and he's now a private citizen in Florida while Joe Biden is president. The only reason Democrats are staging this trial is to keep Trump off the ballot in 2024. Neutralizing him as a political force and dividing the Republican Party are the ultimate aims. Republicans will give Trump an undeserved pass, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. But that doesn't make the trial a pointless exercise. While none of history's four presidential impeachments led to removal, they all had seismic consequences. This one emphasizes the gravity of Trump's efforts to overturn the election and will do severe and possibly lethal damage to Trump's hope to position himself for a 2024 comeback and to remain the GOP's dominant force. The trial will leave him and his defenders exposed and weakened. That won't be justice, but it may be enough. We'll go into a shorter second main story. A mutating threat from COVID-19. What happened? With new cases of COVID-19 steadily declining in the U.S. and the vaccination rollout speeding up, scientists were warning states this week to keep social distancing measures in place to protect against fast-spreading variants of the disease. Some 79,000 Americans are currently hospitalized with the coronavirus, the lowest number in nearly 3 months. And the U.S. is now reporting just under 100,000 new cases a day, less than half of last month's peak. Vaccinations are picking up. 10% of Americans have now received at least one shot, and about 1.4 million doses are being administered per day. To accelerate the speed of inoculation, the Biden administration authorized the deployment of 1,100 active duty troops to help build and man mass vaccination sites. A new study found that cases of the UK COVID variant, which is up to 40% more infectious than earlier strains, are doubling every 10 days in the U.S. By March, the variant is expected to be the dominant strain in the country. We're in the eye of the hurricane, said Dr. Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine. The big wall is about to hit us again. Health experts are also worried by a highly contagious variant that has caused a massive second wave in South Africa and appears able to evade some of the vaccines. South Africa halted distribution of AstraZeneca's shot this week after a small-scale clinical trial suggested it was only about 10% effective against the variant. At least 6 cases of the strain have been detected in the U.S. What the columnist said. States are easing COVID-19 restrictions at the worst possible time, said Holly Yan and Christina Matsouris in CNN.com. Iowa and North Dakota have taken the recent dip in case numbers as an invitation to drop mask mandates, while New Jersey and New York are allowing indoor restaurants to reopen at 35% and 25% capacity, respectively. But letting our guard down now will allow the highly contagious variants to trample the U.S. At least 463,000 Americans have already died of COVID. How many more will perish needlessly in the coming months? Joe Biden promised over and over again on the campaign trail that he had a plan to end the pandemic quickly, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. Yet it's now being reported that his COVID response team thinks the U.S. might not reach herd immunity, which will require about 80% of the population to be inoculated, until at least Thanksgiving. President Biden can argue that the Trump administration botched the initial rollout, but if the pace of vaccinations doesn't accelerate soon, that's all on him. To beat this disease, we can't just focus on our own nation, said Dr. Ashish Jha in the Washington Post. Runaway outbreaks will always produce viral mutations, and travel bans won't stop variants born overseas from reaching our shores. That's why the U.S. must launch a Manhattan Project-like effort to build factories here and abroad that could produce billions of vaccines for the entire world. Like it or not, we really are in this together. Time for the controversy of the week, titled this week, Elections. Should it be easier or harder to vote? Republicans failed to help Donald Trump steal the election in 2020, said Ari Berman in MotherJones.com, but they're already trying to steal the next one. Horrified by the record turnout that powered Joe Biden's narrow victory in swing states, GOP lawmakers in 28 states have introduced 106 separate bills restricting citizens' access to the ballot box. If enacted, the bills would curtail early and absentee voting, impose more stringent voter ID requirements, reduce the number of polling places and ballot drop boxes, eliminate automatic and same-day registration programs, and make it easier for Republican officials to purge voter rolls of Democrats. As always, Republicans are justifying their voter suppression efforts in the name of ballot integrity, said the Washington Post in an editorial. But that's hard to square with a proposed Arizona bill that would empower the state's legislature to simply decertify unfavorable election results and let them choose their own electors. Republicans are keenly aware that their base of white, rural, mostly male voters is being steadily outnumbered by minorities, young progressives, and educated suburban women. As Alice Olenek, a GOP election official in Georgia, put it, new voting restrictions are needed so that we at least have a shot at winning. We're at a fundamental crossroads in American politics, said Ronald Brownstein in TheAtlantic.com. Democrats can't block those anti-democratic measures at the state level. 17 of those 28 states are under full Republican control. But the House is poised to pass H.R. 1, or the For the People Act, which would mandate automatic voter registration in every state, along with unlimited absentee voting and 15 days of early voting. The bill would also prohibit extreme gerrymandering and so-called dark money campaign funding while restoring voting rights to ex-felons. Republicans will no doubt filibuster the bill, so unless Democrats can persuade all of their 50 senators to abolish the filibuster, expanded voting rights is dead on arrival. That will have enormous consequences for the future balance of power between the parties. The Democrats' bill isn't about defending democracy, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. It's about cementing Democratic political power. The bill is designed to auto-enroll likely Democratic voters, such as food stamp recipients, while enshrining in law fraud-susceptible practices such as ballot harvesting and same-day registration, all the while making it harder for Republican candidates to raise money, said Jack Fowler in NationalReview.com. Banning anonymous political donations may sound neutral, but the left routinely shames, ostracizes, and organizes boycotts of Republican donors. H.R. 1 might be better named the For the People Who Are Not Conservatives Act. Both parties assume that making it easier to vote helps Democrats, said Bill Scherer in WashingtonMonthly.com. But that's hardly certain. The massive turnout in 2020 no doubt helped Biden, but the predicted blue wave did not materialize. Republicans flipped 15 House seats and won big in state elections. The GOP needs to start thinking long-term, said Lee Drutman in The Washington Post. If Republicans double down on restricting voting rights, they might squeeze out another decade of power before being crushed by the demographic tide. To stay competitive, the GOP needs to nominate moderates who can win elections without voter suppression, gerrymandering, and other anti-democratic dark arts. By forcing the Republicans to evolve sooner rather than later, H.R. 1 is the long-term rescue package they desperately need. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems that it was a good week for children. After a bill was introduced in North Carolina's state legislature that would raise the state's legal marrying age from 14 to 18. GOP State Representative Jason Sain said the state has disturbingly become a tourist destination for those looking to marry children. It's a good week for getting your stuff after Kanye West moved 500 pairs of sneakers out of the Southern California home he shared with his estranged wife, Kim Kardashian, who is vacationing in the Caribbean. And it was a good week for frozen assets. After retired Navy Lieutenant Paul Grisham, 91, of California, was reunited with a brown leather wallet that he lost in 1967 while stationed at a research base in Antarctica. The wallet was discovered behind a locker when the base was demolished in 2015, and Grisham thanked the long series of people involved who tracked me down. But it was a bad week for sore losers after the mother of Kansas City Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes complained about the officiating during his team's loss in a tweet to Gisele Bündchen, the wife of victorious Tampa Bay quarterback Tom Brady. If you have to have the ref on your team, is that really winning? Randy Mahomes tweeted. It was a bad week for mixed messages. After organizers of the rescheduled Tokyo Olympics announced that it will ban hugs, high fives, and other unnecessary forms of physical contact this summer, but will distribute 150,000 free condoms to residents of the Olympic Village. Finally, it was a bad week for unseen enemies after the British mathematician Kit Yates calculated that the 2 quintillion very tiny coronavirus particles in the world would fit inside a single Coke can. Short news piece before we move from this page. Supreme Court of the United States lifts ban on indoor worship. A divided Supreme Court struck down California's prohibition on services in houses of worship in areas of the state hard hit by COVID-19, and instead imposed a 25% capacity restriction. The 6-3 ruling found that the state's order had violated the right to the free exercise of religion, but it did uphold a ban on singing and chanting. The court's six conservative jurists issued three separate opinions. If Hollywood may host a studio audience or film a singing competition, while not a single soul may enter California churches, synagogues, and mosques, wrote Justice Neil Gorsuch in one, something has gone seriously awry. In dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote that judges are not scientists who should create public health policies. We're on the briefing page now. Title this week is After the Black Lives Matter Protests. Millions of Americans took to the street last summer to demand police reform. Did anything change? What did the protesters want? A fundamental transformation of American policing. After watching the horrific video of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin driving his knee into George Floyd's neck for 7 minutes and 46 seconds, killing the 46-year-old black man as three other cops stood by, an estimated 26 million Americans marched in the streets of cities and towns across the nation. The largest U.S. protest movement since the Vietnam War demanded sweeping police reform, arguing that law enforcement was militarized and systematically racist. Minneapolis had supposedly been a model of less radical reform, installing a black police chief, requiring de-escalation training and body cameras, and implementing a system of flag misbehaving officers. But after Floyd's death, there was widespread sense that the reform didn't work, so we have to rethink policing completely, said anti-crime expert Chuck Wexler. By mid-June, public opinion had swung dramatically in that direction, with 69% of U.S. adults, including 65% of white people, saying the criminal justice system needed major changes or a complete overhaul. What was actually done? Denver, St. Louis, and three other cities enacted all eight Can't Wait reforms endorsed by the activist group Campaign Zero, including requiring officers to attempt de-escalation and issue a warning before firing their weapon. Most cities and states, however, reformed around the edges. Philadelphia, Phoenix, and 30 of the other 65 largest U.S. police departments barred officers from using chokeholds or other neck restraints. 21 cities, including Atlanta, San Diego, and Dallas, required officers to intervene if a colleague used excessive force. Seattle and Philadelphia outlawed the use of tear gas for crowd control, while Denver and Washington, D.C. barred police from indiscriminately firing rubber bullets at demonstrators. Louisville banned the kind of no-knock search warrant that led to the fatal shooting of Breonna Taylor last March, and Houston prohibited officers from kneeling on a suspect's neck. Albuquerque and Olympia, Washington, tasked civilian crisis responders with defusing nonviolent situations called into 911. Many communities also took steps to hold police officers more accountable for their behavior with civilians. In what way? California required a prosecutor in its state attorney general's office to investigate every police shooting that resulted in the death of an unarmed civilian. New York State created a special prosecutor's unit to probe deaths resulting from encounters with police. Massachusetts and New York State revoked qualified immunity, which shields government employees from civil lawsuits for on-the-job behavior. New York also required police departments to disclose alleged officer misconduct, and Denver mandated that officers report every time they point a firearm at someone. Connecticut joined several states in broadening requirements for body cameras. A swath of cities from San Francisco to Pittsburgh created independent police oversight commissions. Why did some proposals fizzle? Legislation encountered fierce resistance. In June, House Democrats passed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which would have required federal police officers to wear body cameras, barred chokeholds, and restricted distribution of military gear to police departments. The bill was dead on arrival in the GOP-controlled Senate, with Republicans saying it would cripple our police force and put the safety of Americans at risk. Even California's overwhelmingly Democratic legislature couldn't agree on a law restricting how police use deadly force. Powerful police unions fought virtually every proposed change, and over time, public attention and support waned. From last June to September, support for the Black Lives Matter movement dropped 10%, according to the Pew Research Center. That drop came when some protests led to an eruption of violence, arson, and looting, with an estimated $1 billion to $2 billion in damage to property. In Minnesota's Twin Cities, at least 1,500 businesses were vandalized, and in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where protests broke out after the August police shooting of Jacob Blake, more than 35 small businesses were destroyed. Has reform helped? There are glimmers of progress. Police misconduct complaints in Baltimore, for example, dropped 40% last year after the department adopted less aggressive tactics. But last year, there were still 1,004 fatal shootings in the U.S., five more than in 2019, and black people continued to be killed at disproportionate rates. Derek Johnson, president and CEO of the NAACP, said the major issues remain. We need to evaluate the culture of police departments, he said. We need to look at the conduct of problematic police officers, and we need to ensure that training police officers entails de-escalation tactics. Read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with The Damage to Working Mothers. The pandemic has been cataclysmic for working mothers, said Helene Olin. It's not just that women, black and Latino women especially, hold a disproportionate share of the customer-facing positions, most likely to be furloughed or eliminated. The issue is the children. With many schools still entirely online and many child care centers closed, it's mostly women who sacrifice their careers to fill the void. Millions of women are now acting as unpaid teacher's assistants, tackling the increased housework that results when everyone is home all the time, and serving as always-on playmates. Many moms can relate to Drisana Rios, a San Diego former insurance executive, who says she was fired because she couldn't keep her yelling toddlers from disrupting Zoom meetings. This summer, a study revealed that one-third of unemployed women under the age of 40 were not working because they needed to mind their children. When school resumed in September, hundreds of thousands of additional women left the workforce, and last month, 275,000 more ceased employment or looking for work. The pandemic has reversed decades of progress, returning women's workforce participation to where it was in the late 1980s. It could take years to undo the damage. To improve mail service, dump DeJoy. Until recently, Americans could depend on their mortgage payments, checks, and other important mail arriving within days of being sent, said USA Today. No more. Under Postmaster Louis DeJoy, the performance of the USPS has badly deteriorated. After DeJoy imposed a series of untested cost-cutting strategies at the same time the coronavirus was depleting the USPS workforce, just 64% of first-class mail was delivered on time during Christmas season. Of non-local first-class mail, only 38% arrived on time, with many letters and periodicals arriving weeks after mailed. Service has improved somewhat, but the affection most Americans have had for the USPS is tarnishing quickly. President Biden can't fire DeJoy, who was hired by the Postal Service's Board of Governors after he donated millions to President Trump and the GOP. But Biden can fire and replace Republican board members who were appointed by Trump, a president who called the USPS a joke. The board can then bring in a professional postmaster, and Congress can repeal a ruinous requirement that the USPS pre-fund billions in pension obligations. DeJoy's incompetence can no longer be tolerated, and for the sake of our mail service, he must be replaced. This column comes from Russia. It's titled, Vindicated in Vaccine Development. Russia is coming to Europe's rescue, said Andrei Samokin. When we became the first country in the world to invent and approve a vaccine against COVID-19 last August, Western experts doubted the shot's efficacy and safety. But in a peer-reviewed study published last week in The Lancet, one of the world's most authoritative medical journals, scientists confirmed that the Sputnik V vaccine is 91.6% effective at preventing symptomatic COVID-19 cases and 100% effective against severe cases. Suddenly, we're seeing a change in Western attitudes toward the Russian vaccine. French President Emmanuel Macron has been enthusiastic, saying the EU will soon review the evidence and is likely to approve the shot. Hungary didn't wait for Brussels' approval and is currently injecting Sputnik into Hungarian arms, while the Czechs, who have one of the highest COVID infection rates in the EU, are considering following suit. Europeans should not have been so skeptical of Russian science. After all, Russia has long been a leader in the production of vaccines and in the ideology of their use, from Catherine the Great through the Soviet Union. The Lancet's nod is an authoritative and serious recognition of Russian achievements that is long overdue. Time for the last word, our in-depth article. The title this week is A World Without Down Syndrome. Widespread prenatal testing means fewer and fewer children are now being born with genetic disabilities, said Sarah Zhang in The Atlantic. Those who remain wonder if society will accept them. Every few weeks or so, Greta Falt Hansen gets a call from a stranger asking a question for the first time. What is it like to raise a child with Down syndrome? Sometimes the caller is a pregnant woman deciding whether to have an abortion. Sometimes a husband and wife are on the line, the two of them in agonizing disagreement. Once, Falt Hansen remembers, it was a couple who had waited for their prenatal screening to come back normal before announcing the pregnancy to friends and family. They called Felt Hansen after their daughter was born with slanted eyes, a flattened nose, and most unmistakable, the extra copy of chromosome 21 that defines Down's syndrome. They were afraid their friends and family would now think they didn't love their daughter. So heavy are the moral judgments that accompany wanting or not wanting to bring a child with a disability into the world. All of these people get in touch with Felt Hansen, a 54-year-old school teacher, because she heads Landsforeningen Downs Syndrome, or the National Down Syndrome Association in Denmark, and because she herself has an 18-year-old son Carl Immel with Down syndrome. Carl Immel was diagnosed after he was born. She remembers how fragile he felt in her arms and how she worried about his health. But mostly she remembers, "I thought he was so cute." 2 years after he was born in 2004, Denmark became one of the first countries in the world to offer prenatal Down syndrome screening to every pregnant woman, regardless of age or other risk factors. Nearly all expecting mothers choose to take the test. Of those who get a Down syndrome diagnosis, more than 95% choose to abort. Denmark is not on its surface particularly hostile to disability. People with Down syndrome are entitled to health care, education, even money for special shoes that fit their wider, more flexible feet. If you ask Danes about the syndrome, they're likely to bring up Morten and Peter, two friends with Down syndrome who starred in popular TV programs where they cracked jokes and dissected soccer games. Yet a gulf seems to separate the publicly expressed attitudes and the private decisions. Since universal screening was introduced, the number of children born with Down syndrome has fallen sharply. In 2019, only 18 were born in the entire country. About 6,000 children with Down syndrome are born in the U.S. each year. Felt Hansen is in the strange position of leading an organization likely to have fewer and fewer new members. The goal of her conversations with expecting parents, she says, is not to sway them against abortion. She fully supports a woman's right to choose. Her conversations with expecting parents are meant to fill in the texture of daily life, missing both from the well-meaning cliche that people with Down syndrome are always happy, and from the litany of possible symptoms provided by doctors upon diagnosis: intellectual disability, low muscle tone, heart defects, gastrointestinal defects, immune disorders, arthritis, obesity, leukemia, dementia. She might explain that, yes, Carl Immel can read. His notebooks are full of poetry written in his careful, sturdy handwriting. He needed physical and speech therapy when he was young. He loves music. His gold-rimmed glasses are modeled after his famous favorite Danish pop stars. He gets cranky sometimes, like all teens do. These parents came to Felt Hansen because they are faced with a choice, one made possible by technology that peers at the DNA of unborn children. Down syndrome is frequently called the canary in the coal mine for selective reproduction. The forces of scientific progress are now marching toward ever more testing to detect ever more genetic conditions. Recent advances in genetics provoke anxieties about a future where parents choose what kind of child to have or not have. But that hypothetical future is already here. It's been here for an entire generation. In January, I took a train from Copenhagen south to the small town of Vordingborg, where Greta Carl Immel and his 30-year-old sister, Anne Katrine Christensen, met me at the station. The three of them formed a phalanx of dark coats waving hello. The weather was typical of January, cold, gray, blustery, but Carl Immel pulled me over to the ice cream shop, where he wanted to tell me he knew the employees. His favorite ice cream flavor, he said, was licorice. "That's very Danish," I said. Greta and Anne Katrine translated. Then he zagged over to a men's clothing store and struck up a conversation with the clerk, who had just seen Carl Immel interviewed on a Danish children's program with his girlfriend, Chloe. "You didn't tell me you had a girlfriend," the clerk teased. Carl Immel laughed, mischievous and proud. We sat down at a cafe, and Greta gave her phone to Carl Immel to busy himself while we spoke in English. He took selfies. His mother, sister, and I began to talk about Down syndrome and the country's prenatal screening program. At one point, Greta was reminded of a documentary that had sparked an outcry in Denmark. She reclaimed her phone to look up the title, "Død over Downs, Death to Down Syndrome." When Carl Emil read over her shoulder, his face crumpled. He curled into the corner and refused to look at us. He had understood, obviously, and the distress was plain on his face. Greta looked up at me. He reacts because he can read. He must be aware of the debate, I asked, which felt perverse to even say. So he's aware there are people who don't want people like him to be born? Yes, she said. Her family has always been open with him. As a kid, he was proud of having Down syndrome. It was one of the things that made him uniquely Carl Emil. But as a teenager, he became annoyed and embarrassed. He could tell he was different. He actually asked me at some point if it was because of Down syndrome that he sometimes didn't understand things, Greta said. I just told him honestly, yes. The decisions parents make after prenatal testing are private and individual ones. But when the decision so overwhelmingly swings one way, to abort, it does seem to reflect something more, an entire society's judgment about the lives of people with Down syndrome. That's what I saw reflected in Carl Emil's face. In the 1970s, when Denmark began offering prenatal testing for Down syndrome to mothers over age 35, it was discussed in the context of saving money, as in the testing cost was less than that of institutionalizing a child with a disability for life. The stated purpose was to prevent birth of children with severe lifelong disability. That language has long since changed. In 1994, the stated purpose of the testing became to offer women a choice. Activists like Felt Hansen have also pushed back against the subtle and not-so-subtle ways that the medical system encourages women to choose abortion. Still, the number of babies born to parents who chose to continue a pregnancy after a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome in Denmark has ranged from 0 to 13 a year since universal screening was introduced. In 2019, there were 7. The day after I met Greta, I attended a meeting of the local Copenhagen Down syndrome group. The woman who invited me, Louise Arso, had a then 5-year-old daughter with Down syndrome, Elia. Arso and her husband had made the unusual choice to opt out of screening. At the meeting, 2 of the 7 other families told me their prenatal screening had suggested extremely low odds. Daniel Christensen was one of the parents who had been told the odds of Down syndrome were very low, something like 1 in 1,500. He and his wife didn't have to make a choice, and when he thinks back on it, he says, "What scares me the most is actually how little we knew about Down syndrome." What would the basis of their choice have been? Their son August is 4 now with a twin sister who Christensen half-jokingly said was almost normal. The other parents laughed. "Nobody's normal," he said. Then the woman to my right spoke. She asked me not to use her name. She wore a green blouse and her blonde hair was pulled into a ponytail. When we all turned to her, I noticed that she began to tear up. "Now, I'm moved from all the stories. I'm a little..." She paused to catch her breath. "My answer is not that beautiful. The Down syndrome odds for her son," she said, "were 1 in 969. "You remember the exact number?" I asked. "Yeah, I do. I went back to the papers." The probability was low enough that she didn't think about it after he was born. On the one hand, I saw the problems. And on the other hand, he was perfect. He is 6 now, and he cannot speak. "It frustrates him," she said. "He fights with his brother and sister. He bites because he cannot express himself. This has just been so many times, and you never feel safe." Her experience is not representative of all children with Down syndrome. Lack of impulse control is common, but violence is not. Her point, though, was that the image of a happy-go-lucky child so often featured in the media is not always representative either. She wouldn't have chosen this life. We would have asked for an abortion if we knew. When Mary Wasserman gave birth to her son Michael in 1961, kids with Down syndrome in America were still routinely sent to state institutions. She remembered the doctor announcing, "It's a mongoloid idiot," the term used before chromosome counting became common, and telling her it should go to the state institution right away. Wasserman had volunteered for a week at such an institution in high school, and she would never forget the sights, the sounds, the smells. The children were soiled, uncared for, unnurtured. In defiance of her doctor, she took Michael home. The early years were not easy for Wasserman, who was a divorced mother for much of Michael's childhood. There weren't really any formal daycares then, and the women who ran informal ones out of their homes didn't want Michael. It wasn't until he was 8, when a school for kids with disabilities opened nearby, that Michael went to school for the first time. Michael is 59 now. The life of a child born with Down syndrome today is very different. After children with disabilities go home from the hospital today, they have access to a bevy of speech, physical, and occupational therapies from the government, usually at no cost to families. Inclusion has made people with disabilities a visible and normal part of society. Thanks to the activism of parents like Wasserman, all of these changes have taken place in her son's lifetime. I can't count how many times in the course of reporting this story, people remark to me, "You know, people with Down syndrome work and go to college now." This is an important corrective to the low expectations that persist, and a poignant reminder of how transforming society has transformed the lives of people with Down syndrome. But while jobs and college are achievements worth celebrating, like any kid's milestones, I've wondered why we so often need to point to achievements for evidence that the lives of people with Down syndrome are meaningful. When I had asked Greta Felt Hansen what it was like to open up her life to parents trying to decide what to do after a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome, I suppose I was asking her what it was like to open up her life to the judgment of those parents, and also of me, a journalist, who was here asking the same questions. As she told me, she had worried at first that people might not like her son, but she understands now how different each family's circumstances can be and how difficult the choice can be. I feel sad about thinking about pregnant women and the fathers, that they are met with this choice. "It's almost impossible," she said. "Therefore, I don't judge them." Carl Immel had grown bored while we talked in English. He tugged on Greta's hair and smiled sheepishly to remind us that he was still there, that the stakes of our conversation were very real and very human. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in The Atlantic. Read one of the obituaries for you. The Shakespearean actor who starred in The Sound of Music, Christopher Plummer, 1929 to 2021. For decades, Christopher Plummer loathed the movie that defined his career. The Sound of Music was awful and sentimental and gooey, the dashingly handsome actor told one interviewer, rechristening the beloved 1965 musical, The Sound of Mucus. He deemed the character Captain Georg von Trapp, the stern, widowed father of 7 folk-singing children, an empty carcass, and likened working alongside the relentlessly upbeat Julie Andrews to being hit over the head daily with a Hallmark greeting card. Plummer was already an acclaimed Shakespearean performer at the time of the filming, The movie made him an international star, and he went on to take scores of memorable roles on stage and screen in a wild variety of genres. He was a charming jewel thief in The Return of the Pink Panther, 1975, a Shakespeare-spouting Klingon villain in Star Trek VI, and a declining Leo Tolstoy in The Last Station, 2009. In old age, he even softened toward his most famous film. "I was a pampered, arrogant young bastard," Plummer wrote in 2008. "I still harbored the old-fashioned stage actor's snobism toward movie making." Born in Toronto to parents who divorced soon after his birth, Plummer was raised in Montreal by his mother, a granddaughter of former Canadian Prime Minister Sir John Abbott, and his grandparents, said the Los Angeles Times. As an only child, he took refuge in literature and developed exquisite diction by reading aloud to his family after dinner. Trained as a concert pianist, he found greater satisfaction in theater, and by 18 was performing classical roles with Canadian repertory companies. Plummer debuted on Broadway in 1954 in The Star-Crossed Story, which closed on its opening night, and played Henry V at Canada's Stratford Festival in 1956, said the Washington Post. Hailed by critics as the new Laurence Olivier, he grew cocky fast and rebuffed movie officers in order to play Hamlet in Ontario for $25 a week. Plummer's film career began in 1958 with a standout role in Sidney Lumet's theatrical comedy Stage Struck, said the Times from UK. The Sound of Music elevated the actor to a new level of fame, and tales of his carousing soon began to spread. He once partied so hard with Tyrone Power that they both contracted hepatitis. His other drinking partners included Richard Burton, Peter O'Toole, and on one occasion, a tequila-swigging horse. Yet his hell-raising rarely interfered with his work, said the New York Times, and he played Macbeth, Richard III, Mark Antony, and Iago on prominent stages to consistent acclaim. Plummer enjoyed something of a late-career movie renaissance. He gave one of his most authoritative performances as real-life newsman Mike Wallace in 1999's The Insider, said The Guardian, and played a psychologist in 2001's Oscar-winning A Beautiful Mind. Plummer received the first Oscar nomination of his long career for 2009's The Last Station, and finally won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for 2010's Beginners, in which he portrays a terminally ill widower who comes out to his son as gay. Addressing the Golden Statuette, in his acceptance speech, the 82-year-old Plummer said, "You're only 2 years older than me, darling. Where have you been all my life?" And we'll finish out on the talking points page. Not quite time for a full article, so we'll stick to the shorter pieces. In a legal brief Donald Trump's lawyers filed with the Senate for the impeachment trial, Trump is referred to 44 times as the 45th president and never as the former president. Trump's spokesman and legal team have adhered to that wording in all communications, evidently to conform to Trump's insistence that he is the rightful winner of the 2020 election. Former President Trump's insistence that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from him has cost taxpayers at least $519 million. That tally includes the cost of sending National Guard troops to Washington, D.C., defending against lawsuits, security for poll workers who face death threats, and repairing damage to the Capitol at the January 6th insurrection. The 200 Catholic dioceses in the U.S. and other Catholic institutions have received at least $3 billion in taxpayer-funded Paycheck Protection Program COVID-19 relief. A church spokeswoman said the PPP was designed to protect the jobs of Americans from all walks of life, faith-based or secular. No troops have died in Afghanistan for a year. The Biden administration says it will keep the current 2,500 troops in that country while it takes a hard look at whether the Taliban are complying with the terms of a peace deal negotiated by the Trump administration. Over in the poll watch, 56% of Americans think Trump should be convicted in his impeachment trial. 43% think he should not be. And as you know by now, 57 senators voted to convict and 43 voted not to. We'll read a couple of quotes. The first from Emily Dickinson. There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away. And we'll finish out with a quote from Aldous Huxley, quoted in the Lock Haven, Pennsylvania Express, who says, "Facts do not cease to exist because they are ignored." Timely quote indeed. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associate, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.